Is this NATO? Hi.
Hey, buddy.
How are you?
Good.
Good. That's NATO Thompson, you guys. This is The Conversation. It's episode 152 with NATO Thompson. He is the artistic director of Creative Time and the author of Seeing Power, Art and Activism in the 21st Century. And if you had asked me, in fact, less than a year ago, at the beginning of this year, do you want to have NATO Thompson on your show? I'd be like, sorry, who's that? And in fact, I vaguely recall, and I, first of all, big thank you, huge thank you to former guest Austin Thomas, New York-based artist, who recommended and connected me to NATO. I vaguely recall when we spoke, I think, over the phone after we had done our conversation. She mentioned this NATO Thompson and said something along the lines of, you know, he's written about activism, politics, something vaguely related to art. And I was like, oh, yeah, I'm open to having, you know, tangentially related people. Point is that not only is NATO Thompson very much related to art in addition to activism, he is also the ideal guest for this forum and format, as you will hear. And that's why I'm breaking this up into two parts. This is part one, episode 152. And the reason is I really want you to be able to digest it. I will very well have maybe two new guests in the can by next week, but I want you as a listener to listen, and if you finish by next week, listen again, you know, get the book. Read the book as a companion as you listen, because there's so much food for thought here. I am going to be recovering from the book and from our conversation for a while as far as digesting, you know, recovering maybe is a little bit of a less than friendly way of putting it, but it's a lot to process, and it's about paradigm shifting, ultimately, for you as a listener, for me as a listener. And by the way, did I mention that I was going to be overselling this episode? I'm going to probably be overselling this episode, so just to warn you. What else can I tell you? Last episode, 151, was with Foyer Messler director and partner Lauren Marinaro. I highly recommend that one if you haven't heard it, so you can hear about what happens when Hurricane Sandy hits your gallery and your gallery fills with water, as well as whether as a gallerist you should put an ad in Artform and how much that costs and, you know, what the pros and cons of actually doing that are. So highly recommend that one. But as far as this one, you know, this is a big moment. That's why we are doing a two-part episode. And let me see what else I can tell you before we get into this. So NATO is the director of Creative Time. What is Creative Time, for those of you who haven't heard? They, it turns out, really put themselves on the map when they did the Twin Tower lights. In other words, they had spotlights in the place of shooting up into the sky in the place of the former Twin Towers. So that was what a project that really, I think, gave them international recognition. More recently, they collaborated with Kara Walker to do that piece called A Subtlety, which has a much longer title. That's the main title, which is the sugar cube or sugar-based sphinx that she and many assistants sculpted that was in the former Domino Sugar Factory over in Williamsburg. And so that was more recent. That was a couple years ago. So those are a couple of projects that you might be familiar with as far as Creative Time. But more importantly, the subjects that NATO raises in his book, I think, are so important, so thought-provoking, and yeah. And so, without further ado, thank you so much for being here. I really want to know what you think of this episode and the next one, part two. So get ready to send some emails. All right. Thank you very much for being here. Let's get to that conversation with Nino Thompson right now.
And now in my speaking voice in my chair.
You are at least my third, I'm not sure if there are more, veteran of the Leonard Lopate show, I realized, since the last time we talked.
I guess I am a Lopate vet. I've been on it twice, I believe.
Okay, so the one time...
I did it once with Vito Conchi.
Oh, wow.
Which was highly entertaining.
Right. What was that like?
Vito is just... He kept, like, grumbling that... He was like, who's in charge of Creative Time? And I was like, I'm one of the people in charge. He's like, but you're just a kid. Uh-huh. And then he was, like, saying things like, the whole world's run by children these days. I was like, I'm 44 years old. I mean,
Did you do a project with him? Was that the occasion for your getting together?
He was speaking at the Creative Time Summit.
So oh, okay.
No, the answer is no.
Right, got it. I see. So it was much more of a wild card situation.
Mean, just to say... I've loved Vito Conchi forever, so.
Right.
Who a lot of people in art. I mean, how can you not? It's pretty fun stuff.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So you are at you're in your office at Creative Time, which, correct me if I'm wrong, is in the East Village, more or less, right?
You're correct.
Okay. And now it's been a while, I want to say this both for us and for people listening, that since we last talked. So if I have any... If anything that's changed, you know, that's why. But do you still live in Philadelphia?
I do.
Okay, great. So this is always a fun place to start. It's, you know, geography, location, mm-hmm. et cetera. So there you are in your East Village office, and you're living in Philadelphia. How many days are you in the office, would you say, average?
I come up for 3 days, typically, mm-hmm. although lately it's four.
Mm-hmm. In advance of the summit?
We're also working on a project with the artist Pedro Reyes right now.
Okay.
Who's actually in town. So
mm-hmm.
yeah, there's a lot of different things we work on.
Right.
It's a busy summer, unfortunately.
Right. Okay. Sorry to hear that. but all that to say that, to sort of set up your commute situation, and it's an interesting one because, you know, you hear obviously about people commuting from, you know, far points of the five boroughs, but also from upstate and, you know, and maybe a little further out in New Jersey. But it's pretty rare from my experience, and tell me if you know a lot of other people doing it, that you hear people commuting from Philadelphia to the city.
I think in the arts it's extraordinarily rare.
Right.
Although, as my commute attests, I certainly am aware that I'm not alone in it.
Right.
Seems to be a lot of wealthy folks. It seems like bankers and fashion people, though I haven't actually interviewed folks.
Right.
But certainly, and I would say just, as, you know, in short order, it is a cost of living question, and it is an incredible city. I love it very much. And I can also own a home and mm-hmm. live in a multiracial block in an affordable area, and things that at this point in history seem almost exotic for an urban situation that only 30 years ago was the given.
So, right. So it's, you know, it's you're kind of, you've kind of chased the American dream, as it were, which, you know, we can obviously question, but to Philadelphia.
Yeah. And yeah. Also to, I mean, I also, you know, at some point, it just seems like New York City's standard living or cost of living are so high, particularly on the housing front.
Right.
That, you know, I'm like 44 now, and I've lived in Philly for 6 years, and I don't know, somewhere in my mid-30s, I looked around all my friends, and I realized everyone's just treading water financially.
Yeah, yep.
And you realize that that day where things are going to work out just never is going to come.
Right.
And so I just had to make a decision.
Yeah. Yeah. About that.
Well,
it's come
funny,
back
too, because you're on the West Coast.
Yes.
Where commuting is a way of being.
Yeah, for a lot of people, indeed. Yeah, it's funny. I've been speaking with so many people on the East Coast, primarily New York, for this mm-hmm. podcast, and not people in LA as much. And at the it was more that way at the beginning, and that really wasn't part of the equation. Now it definitely would be, but mm-hmm. So Oh, here's what I want to ask you about the Philadelphia New York commute is, do you get, or did you at one point get whiplash from, you know, being in the a city that offers possibilities to one that does not, where you work?
Yeah, you mean in terms of the arts?
No, just in terms of a modern, you know, a contemporary person in the world being in a livable quote unquote city, to coming into Manhattan, you know, and being surrounded by, I don't know, I'll let you describe sort of what the landscape there is like, but, you know, you've obviously seen it change by day, by year, and so on.
Well, many people have, and, you know, certainly New York City is unique. Not unique. There's a few in the United States that are hitting this kind of
right. Global
city scale of density and cost. I think San Francisco, obviously, is one of those cities that is pricing out anybody that you'd want to hang out with.
Right,
so
exactly.
It's just tricky, you know, obviously. I mean, at the same time, you know, with the growth here comes a lot of job opportunities. And I would say the arts in many ways in the United States system survives as a sort of leech on luxury money.
Right, yeah.
And so, you know, where there's expendable income, there's the arts, whether it's galleries or nonprofits that support art or what have you.
Yeah.
The current structure is such that it really needs that kind of money to keep going, unless it's going to entirely survive on foundations, which is, you know, not particularly tenable. So that's just to say, that's also why there's a massive arts economy in New York City.
Right.
And so it's one of these things that feeds on itself. That said, of course, you know, and I don't want to get cliche, but everyone understands, like, pricing out artists is not necessarily good for an art scene. And I think everyone's struggling to find a way to make that work. But I still think the arts do happen a lot in New York City. And also, I would say that the city is very good at going to stuff. Mm-hmm. In so much as people attend art shows and go to museums and
right. Go
to cultural events, and perhaps it is a city where people are used to doing things outside of their home.
Yeah.
And so it's great in that sense too. I mean, you know, I don't want to be so negative about New York, because certainly what amazes me is when we do projects here, people show up.
Right.
You know, there's an audience, and that's in a culturally curious audience, and that's exciting.
Yeah.
I just can't stand how unaffordable it is, and I think any New Yorker you talk to will say the same thing.
Right.
So I think that is a bit of a crisis that everybody's trying to get their head around.
That's all I was kind of trying to get to, is the fact that, you know, you're getting on the train in Philadelphia, you know, with perhaps these fashion and banker people, you know, and you're getting off in Manhattan, and, you know, and just going to your office, you know, what that experience is like having left Philadelphia. It seems like it would be quite a bit different, but I guess, you know, you're also surrounded by art types.
And also, too, I mean, but it's, you know, I mean, I have some basic needs, which is, Kurt Vonnegut has a saying, which is, we are what we pretend to be, so we must be careful what we pretend to be.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I think about that when people hang out at cocktail parties and talk about art too much,
mm-hmm.
that you start thinking that is the arts. And I find having some distance from the
right.
kind of critical mass of the art world extraordinarily helpful in just gaining some sort of perspective.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's nice on my block. Like, no one cares that I work in the arts. I mean, I think it's cool, but it's not like, oh, my God, you know what I mean? It's not,
mm-hmm.
you can't name drop on my block.
What a shame.
It might just maybe the councilman or something, you know what I mean? But
yeah.
it's not, it would be locally driven. And I find that it's helpful. And also just in terms of, I think it's really important to be around class and race on a very lived level, not just something abstractly lived, but something that
right.
you experience with your friend groups, with the people you spend time with, how you get home, what you see with your own eyes on a daily basis. That's important.
Yeah. Well, the nonprofit characterization that you were starting to describe is something I want to get into. But before we do that, I want to go back to something that you and I briefly talked about when we last spoke, which is that you're from Santa Clarita. You grew up there,
yeah.
correct?
I mean, yeah, I did a big chunk of my life over there.
Big chunk
you
there.
Know, high school,
right.
junior high.
Okay, well, that qualifies, I
formative
think.
Paranoic anxiety over
right.
years.
Right. And so the question I want to start with is, did your one or both of your parents teach at CalArts or work at CalArts?
My father was in grad school at CalArts. That's the reason I went there.
Uh-huh. And what happened after he finished grad school?
We stayed.
Okay. So and, he just settled in?
So,
as,
yeah, he went to CalArts, and we all relocated from Oregon to Southern California. And, yeah, and that's actually a big introduction to the arts for me was when my brother and I first came there, my father was living in Amundsen Dormitory, and we lived in the dorms with him for a summer.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, it was amazing. I mean, that back then, the pool was entirely naked.
Right. That's the classic
and
reputation from those days.
The parties were very crazy. I'm sure they still are. But I remember, like, walking through the halls, and there was just installation art with people smoking pot in it, and it just seemed like some sort of alternative living situation. And there's graffiti over all the walls in the basement where my dad had his studio.
Mm-hmm.
And Don Cheadle, the actor, was an undergrad and would play D&D with me and my brother, Dungeons and Dragons.
Speaking of name dropping, yeah.
It was really, really fun. It was a great place to be in junior high for a bit.
Right. So did your dad, to what extent is your dad still an artist?
My dad's a painter.
Okay.
And he also works in the film industry, television film industry currently.
Mm-hmm.
He's been a gaffer for a long time in films.
Mm-hmm.
And so he worked on Desperate Housewives. Then he worked on the show Parenthood.
Mm-hmm.
He's currently working on the Mindy Project.
Mm-hmm.
So he's worked in the industry, as they say.
Right.
Where y'all are.
Yeah, yeah.
For quite a long time. And
right.
Backwards and forwards.
Right. So the reason I ask is I wonder how much being around art and then, you know, just him as an artist became something that you ultimately gravitated towards organically, or, you know, at some point you felt like you wanted to get away from that.
No, I think it was very much in
it was set.
DNA and culturally.
Right.
Being around that was hugely influential. And my mother and father are both very arty people, not just strictly visual arts, but also going to dance performances, going
mm-hmm.
to theater.
Right.
Just also just being strange as a daily way of being in the world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right.
There's a certain kind of, you know, I always thought being an artist was more of a way you lived your life than it was a profession.
Yeah, right.
The kind of curious, adventurous, bohemian approach to things.
Yeah. And do you feel like, just big picture, since we're talking kind of big picture now, that mm-hmm. getting into curating is, you know, having been exposed to art so early and, you know, in the art community so early, was in one way the ultimate way to be exposed to both contemporary art and the arts in a really broad way, as opposed to an artist on a much more specific level?
Well, you know, I think it's funny. I didn't even know curating was a job for so long. I didn't know it existed. But not to answer your question in kind of a broad strokes way, I just think that I found that I spent a lot of time with people that were artists that seemed to have difficulty making friends.
Right.
And I found I had this art of bringing people together that were deeply antisocial.
Right.
And so I guess in some ways that was a hint that curating was a thing in terms of a social kind of thing.
Wow.
And I can't make anything to save my life. So I guess it was trying to find where my skill sets fit within a milieu that appealed to me.
Right. Who's the Nato Thompson of Los Angeles or Southern California? Do you know? You described the connecting of, you know, sort of antisocialish artists, and I'm just thinking there aren't any curators like that out here. Yeah. Okay. So we're gonna dive into your book, Seeing Power: Art and Activism in the 21st Century. I wanted to know how much touring you've been doing, or conversations, or, you know, readings, or what have you.
I've done a lot over the last year.
Mm-hmm.
Did some stuff in Virginia at a book festival. I did some interviews I did another podcast, I believe. I think I'm doing something with, I did a talk in Chicago. I've done some talks and stuff. It's been great.
Good. It's been a blur, though.
I mean, It's not to be narcissistic, but to say something very obvious that some people don't recognize. When you write a book, you're kind of eager to get feedback. I find, it's not like I'm like ambivalent about the book. These are things I care deeply about. So the opportunity to talk through the ideas with people and just get a sense of where people's heads are at with it's very helpful for me. So I enjoy it thoroughly.
So what has been the takeaway from talking to people about it at these readings and whatnot?
That's interesting. I think that there's a lot of different ideas that float around there. And certainly the one that gets the most traction, I think there's some ideas that are just really much, I don't want to say simpler, but just speak more to a direct experience. So a lot of the stuff about jobs touches on people very fast, of course, because I think that's where people's heads are at.
Right.
And I think also when I talk, we can get into it, but when I talk about infrastructures, that is in some ways talks about employment and jobs and stuff. And I think that's the kind of thing. And then the other part, which is sometimes I think it's just because it's the first chapter and people spend more time on the first chapter than the rest.
Right.
Like the last chapter is the one that gets the last, I'm realizing the last chapter is the one that gets the least reading. But the first chapter kind of talks also about just, I guess it's the second one, but about the ambiguous and the didactic in contemporary art.
Right.
And that I get a lot of discussions about, which I found very helpful and fun. And I did a nice Facebook chat with Tom Finkelpearl, who's the cultural commissioner for New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked a lot about those issues, and it was really helpful to talk with him about it because he's sort of the pragmatist school of John Dewey, in a sense. I think he's I think he and I share a certain kind of affinity for the didactic, but also a healthy appreciation for the poetic. Mm-hmm. But it was really nice to talk about that because sometimes I think in the arts, people are very just like allergic to the word didactic in general.
Right. Yeah. Well, we'll cover some of that. Before we dive in, I want to say that your book is about 164 pages. I had approximately 40-some bookmarked or posted pages. So that means more than about a quarter of your book I had bookmarked. And we're only going to probably get to a small fraction of those. So if we may say a moment of silence for the things that we do not get to right now.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. There it is. Okay. I thought we would set it up by... I basically took the most bolded sections for me and basically put them in a bit of... Not chronological order, but sort of an sectional order. And the first section has to do with the perception of art. And so this comes from page 40. And so this is the first section that I want to read, and I'll kind of try to get through it quickly. You write, "The arts often provide a safe haven for projects that escape basic notions of common sense, that are by design irrational, confusing, opaque, non-literal, open-ended, poetic, and absurd. This embrace of the obscure is often liberating for artists themselves, but for many viewers focused on political change, these absurd antics can resemble a room full of jesters juggling before a king, the weirdness easily being dismissed as entertainment for a bored ruling class. This reactive and suspicious tendency has left the absurdist edge of contemporary art outside the analytic lens of many political activists. Nonetheless, this work often has much to offer." So there's a lot we could dig into there, but I want to, I guess, use that as a starting point, but also to say that for me, and I think for you too, in a lot of ways, I think the art that we see certainly in the marketplace, if not maybe a little bit outside of it, often does feel like the jesters juggling before a king.
Oh, yes, definitely.
Yeah. And in fact, just to borrow a phrase that Ben Davis used when I spoke to him, this concept of considering or looking or being focused on the market, that's just not where you want to be. That's essentially what he said. So I kind of feel like you are simpatico with him in that regard.
Sure, totally.
Yeah. Is there anything else you want to address about that particular quote before I get to the next one?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a few things to say about it. One
sure.
is that when we talk about perception, And let's face it, you know, who has a clear-eyed view of the art world? I mean, when I go to art fairs, like if I go to Art Basel, Miami or something, right?
How often do you do that?
I look around. I used to go more. I've really tapered off a lot, but I did go to the Armory last time. So I probably hit an art fair a year, depending on which one, but not more than that lately. But when I go, I'm always like, who are all these people?
Right. Yeah.
And I'm like, what is this place? And like, what is that gallery? And what, you know, like I'm always mystified by the scale of these things. Or, you know, you'll go by booth and you're like, who that, what artist is that? Which is just to say, and I don't mean this in a catty way. I just mean to say it is a hard place to understand, even for those that have spent their entire life living in it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So for those that are not within that inside knowledge, it's even more bizarre to look at.
Right.
And I would say that the money part of it, and certainly the money part, is hard not to notice with those fairs. You see those prices on those things, and it's hard not to have that be the most dominant thing in your mind.
Right.
You're like, people are paying how much for what?
Right.
Right? And there is certainly a giant part of the art world, and historically so, that really is supplying luxury goods to the ruling class of the world.
Right.
And if that isn't somehow, how can one not be hypnotized if not, it's like almost hypnotized slash repulsed by it.
Yeah.
You know, when you go to the Venice Biennale, and Roman Abramovich has the world's largest yacht pulled up to it in the number one parking spot, it almost eclipses what happens in the art show, because a lot of people walk by that and go, that's the world's largest yacht.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's, you know, for most humans on this planet, we are completely removed from the machinations of, in terms of the personal relationships to these people. And the art world gives you some glimpse of that world, and it's insane. So I just to say, I think it is a hard thing to overcome to be sympathetic to the arts.
Yeah. The thing that I can take away from what you just said, which goes back to the comment or the conversation you often had with people having done readings of the book around jobs, you know, is yes, that's kind of horrible, and, you know, people get, you know, stars in their eyes or dollar signs in their eyes. But if there's one way that you can frame the dichotomy of artist survival, and that is, one, that they make work that is marketable and that ultimately then does go and support that oligarchical class, or they can take the more socially conscious political activists, et cetera, route, go ahead.
And I would say, too, just on a third frame, too, I think a lot of folks, there's very few artists that are making any money.
Right.
Like, you know, you would think the art world is full of people getting rich by the brand of it all.
Yeah.
But in fact, most people are locked out of that.
Right.
In terms of numbers.
Right.
So, you know, like, even for the Machiavellian artist that's going to produce the most, like, poetic works that'll sell to the ruling class, most of them are still locked out. You know what I mean?
Right.
So so I think that, and I also say, just to even go to that quote, because it's a complicated kind of set of situations, I just feel like I need to state the obvious for fear of being misunderstood.
Sure.
I am very sympathetic of the desire of artists to not be utilitarian and to embrace their irrational sides and to feel freedom to express themselves in a myriad of ways.
Right.
And I also am very suspicious of an activist world that in some ways clings to usefulness and instrumentality out of sheer paranoia, because they do not understand what's exactly going on with the more poetic things of the world. I think that those dynamics have, in some ways, squeezed out the dreams in a lot of the activist community. But I would also say I'm very sympathetic to the activists, because I do, like many activists, feel like there are deep inequities in our lives that need to be addressed and corrected.
Right.
And that there, and I feel the impatience that is driving that as well.
Do you feel, when you say you feel the impatience, are you referring to sort of the collective group of social activist artists that you know, or you, or more just the feeling that's sort of bubbling all around you, like when, you know, the feeling you have
all around me?
Yeah.
You know, like from like Black Lives Matter activists, they're like, I don't want to wait, you know?
Right, right.
This has to change now. They're parked out in front of City Hall in New York right now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I just think, like, I'm with you. You know, let's change this thing.
Right. Well, one of the things, speaking of that, which, you know, it might come in a quote later on, but the urgency of things, one of the things you talked about in the book is, you certainly talked a lot about Occupy Wall Street. And you talked also about, more specifically in the art context, Occupy museums. And you describe them as, you know, as being effective and important. But you also characterize the fact that they kind of moved on and didn't really give it, you persist enough to kind of make things settle in, that it required a longer term kind of thing. And I just wonder, you know, this book is, I guess, about a year old now, right? So I just wonder, Black Lives Matter aside, if you feel that there's anything that has been bubbling up with that sense of urgency, or if things are still kind of in the, you know, beginning phases.
There's a few things that have changed. One, to go to Occupy, because I just read an article talking about how Black Lives Matter is a really important movement. They made a lot of progress, unlike Occupy, that didn't make any progress, is what the, and just to qualify this, this is written in Forbes magazine.
Of course.
But you know what? I got to say, the candidacy of Bernie Sanders, and just looking at the way this election has played out, you can't have Bernie Sanders in that kind of momentum without Occupy.
Right, right.
And I think that and in fact, it's been very helpful for me personally to see that social movements can change the narrative.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Because it did. It did.
Yeah.
And people were always looking for, like, oh, you didn't get anybody into office, or you didn't put any policy decisions out there. But I think one can certainly say that Bernie Sanders has radically shifted the narrative around social in this country.
Yeah.
And that's profound. And then to go to Occupy museums, where I would say a few things. One, I feel for artists because, you know, they got lives and jobs, and it's hard to keep these collective things moving on a long-term basis. No one's getting paid,
right,
you know?
Right.
And the other thing, too, is, like, you know, there was a movement for, in terms of Occupy museums with a group called Gulf Labor, which is kind of a spin-off group. They're not the same, but they are related. So we share a lot of similar members.
Mm-hmm.
And that was putting pressure on the Guggenheim to actually meet basic labor rights. They had a set of demands, which I cannot articulate right now, but in terms of the labor conditions for the people building the Guggenheim Abu Dhabi, they were really voicing their dissent over their labor practices.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that public shaming drove the Guggenheim completely crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it also reverberated throughout the art world in terms of their own set of practices, you know?
Yeah.
And trying to be more careful. And then in London, this group Liberate Tate successfully got British Petroleum to step off this, stopping a sponsor of Tate Modern.
Mm. Right.
And in that way, and I think that it also shifted the mood of institutions around these issues.
Yeah.
But I don't want to pat anyone on the back too far, because of course, like, Guggenheim basically stopped negotiating Gulf Labor, they're continuing to build the museum, so, you know, I don't want to make it seem like it's all roses either.
Right, right. The description, the characterization that you gave a little while ago, that's this crossing point, nexus, whatever, you know, of artists going in one of a few, two or three directions, made me get to one of my must-visit sections of your mm-hmm. book, which is this individual. Mm-hmm. Okay, so from towards the end of the book, you mm-hmm. cite a number of situations where people are artists, activist groups, and so on. And you mention this one guy. You write, in 1993, the artist Rick Lowe started Project mm-hmm. Row Houses in the Third Ward of Houston. It contains 8 studios for visiting artists, studios for art with African-American themes, and child care for single mothers in the neighborhood who want to attend college. And then you cite a quote from Lowe, which was in the New York Times. He says, "I was doing big billboard-sized paintings and cut-out sculptures dealing with social issues, and one of the students, I assume a student at wherever he was teaching?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One of the students told me that, sure, the work reflected what was going on in his community, but it wasn't what the community needed. If I was an artist, he said, why didn't I come up with some kind of creative solution to issues instead of just telling people like him what they already know? That was the defining moment that pushed me out of the studio." So that was just, I feel like in thinking about that quote from this guy, one of the things that occurred to me is, I wonder if as artists in 2016, we're all just on some level waiting for that student to come up to us and say, why don't you do something that actually helps our community? But nobody's getting asked that question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, it's a few things there too, because of course, what's interesting about Project Row Houses for me is an art project,
mm-hmm.
is it does something that I think is, and I thought about this before because I wrote a piece about a place called Experimental Station in Chicago
mm-hmm.
that's run by an artist named Dan Peterman. But in terms of these kind of infrastructures that are also experimental art spaces, right? So Project Row Houses is certainly not a painting, right?
Right.
It's physical space. It has programs. People maneuver through it. And it's certainly related to the local community that it's in. You know, it's in dialogue with them and personal relationships with them. And it's been going on for now, I don't even know how many years, 18 or something like that. But it occurred to me that the kind of conversation around infrastructures or just, you know, you could just say nonprofits or mm-hmm. for-profits,
mm-hmm.
Also in many ways allowed one to imbricate or bring into conversation art institutions, right? So that rather than thinking art is just the thing inside LACMA,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
That the logic of art is also in LACMA itself. And that one has to think through the political economies that are, because of course, to go to kind of classic institutional critique of Hans Hacke, classically, everyone wants the art to just be there, and you don't worry about the place it's in,
mm-hmm.
right? It's just this invisible space.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's key to consider the kit and caboodle
mm-hmm.
of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I say that to go because I believe that also one gets a lot more political leverage
mm-hmm.
and possibility when one starts approaching things that way. So that when someone says, hey, why aren't you doing something in my community? You're just a painter, right?
Right.
Well, maybe just a painter who paints these incredible paintings just needs to show them in the right places.
Mm.
Or maybe has a different relationship to the places in which they are operating within.
Right.
You know, because I don't think it's okay. I think it's misleading to feel like everyone has to be a Rick Lowe, you know?
Right.
Because some people are good at that stuff, and some people aren't.
Right.
Not everybody needs to start a 18-year project, and you know, with real estate. I don't think that's the answer. But
right.
I do think it is important to bear in mind that when one is working in cahoots with places that think around race and equity and where their money is going, from whom to whom,
mm-hmm.
art benefits greatly from thinking through those things.
Right. Right. And isn't a model that is maybe very early that artists are making art, but they're also, you know, getting involved, maybe a small number of cases with housing rights issues and gentrification and so on.
I mean, I've seen a lot of that now.
Okay.
And I also would say the conversation, I mean, God, it's like, how do you not have a conversation about gentrification all the time? I don't know.
Yeah.
But it is certainly the kind of crucible that is gentrification brings up a lot of things around race, around home ownership, about political economy, about urbanism, about capitalism, and the arts. And they're all kind of intertwined in there. And I think that it's been really helpful in pushing people to think more carefully about these things.
Yeah. Well, a pair of anecdotes from, you used to work at you were a curator, correct, at Mass MoCA. Is that your title? You were a curator there?
Yep.
Okay. So the pair of anecdotes from Mass MoCA, I think, is we can't not talk about, just to sort of set up this complicated dynamic of audience and patronage and viewers and so on. So the first one is, when you worked at Mass MoCA, you said, we asked a Harvard class to study audience reception of an exhibition I organized called Becoming Animal, which explored the porous space between humans and animals. To put their conclusion in simple terms, they found that the more the audience knew about art, the fewer interpretive connections they made with the work. While people who knew about art focused on minute aesthetic maneuvers, those that did not made giant leaps in regard to what the work could possibly mean, drawing upon a vast range of personal references. One could argue that the lesson of their study is that the more one knows about art, the less one gets out of it, but this would be overstating the matter considerably. The more important lesson is simply that the more one knows about art, the more radically different one's approach is to art compared with that of the general viewer. And then, to confuse things tremendously, I wanted to jump to your later reference of another show at Mass MoCA that you curated called The Interventionists, which looked at political interventions from a wide array of cultural producers and activists from around the world. It was a highly visual and social show designed to be people-friendly and provocative. Downstairs from the political art exhibition, we had on view, and I assume this was maybe a case of circumstance and maybe necessity, perhaps. You can talk about that later. But we had on view paintings from Leipzig on loan from the Rubel family collection in Florida. In political art circles, it is a widely held belief that painting is the enemy, unless, of course, it is a painting that points out some political atrocity. Displaying a collection of paintings by multiple white male German painters would thus strike many as a particularly egregious example of museums perpetuating the power of the ruling class. What I found interesting is that many visitors preferred the painting show. They simply got more out of it. More visitors preferred painting because painting is a medium they understand to be unambiguously art. It made sense that this is what they would be drawn to in a contemporary art museum. I even overheard a visitor castigating the Interventionist exhibition as a show geared for art elites and rich people. Paintings were the public, and activist art was for art elites. It is in moments like these that I have to take a step back and think carefully about what it is exactly the political cultural production is doing. For in the opinion of many visitors, forms that are unfamiliar and alienating can lead to a quick assumption that museum belongs to a useless insider world that does not have their best interest at heart. The paranoia, and I wanted to mention this last line because it mentions the title of your book, the paranoia of seeing power is often a shorthand for dismissal. At Mass MoCA, the public had misread productive ambiguity as a nefarious conspiracy. So that sounded
probably... I got to tell you, I'm really loving the part you're picking here.
Thank you. Yeah, that is just so provocative. And you pair those two together, and it's like, what am I to make of this, you know? So on one hand, to set this up a little further, as you were talking just a minute ago, I was thinking back to the way you were describing New York, you know? It's like... yeah, you know, it's ridiculously expensive to live here, and that's kind of crazy, but the people turn out for the art, you know? They turn out. They're passionate. And I'm thinking, well, wait a second. Who are these people exactly, you know? You're at Mass MoCA. It's a completely different demographic set that's going to see these shows. Who is the artist then to think about, you know? The artist is now completely schizophrenic in terms of who their audience is when you look at all these examples together.
Oh, my God, yeah. I mean, what a pain in the ass book, because these riddles really fuck with your head.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, certainly the first thing I'll say is, working at Mass Mocha, and also being in New York, I challenge a lot of people's assumptions about who the audiences are.
Right.
Because I think there's a kind of skepticism that museums only attract these kind of upper middle class elite, right?
Yeah.
But they wouldn't survive if that were the case. MoMA wouldn't have record breaking attendance if that were the case.
Right.
You know, when I worked at Mass Mocha too, like, I saw just everyday people go into these places. You know, I think people underestimate the scale and complexity of that thing we call audiences,
right,
at museums. And in some ways, I think that we're used to self-ghettoizing in the arts.
Mm-hmm.
Or, like, always assuming, I don't know what we assume. It's like, I always feel like the first sign you know someone works in the arts is if they hate the art world. You're like, well, then you're really in the arts. Because everyone else is kind of okay with it. But
right.
If you're in the arts, you get to really hate it.
Right.
We got a tortured life in here. And I sympathize. But certainly, I think in terms of these questions, like, it's a delicate thing about trying to understand who your audiences are. And particularly for political artists, it's a lot to put on them because audiences are complex. And also people's reference points are very complex. You know, and I love the interventionist show, and these artists spend a lot of time trying to think through ways to navigate a complex public.
Mm-hmm.
It was in those moments where I was looking at that painting show and thinking how, people just were like, oh, painting, that's art. I get it. You know what I mean? And really enjoying it on face value.
Mm-hmm.
That I was like, wow, that's really amazing, actually. Right?
Yeah.
Like, they're not all caught up with our conspiracy theories about the role of painting in the world. They're
right.
Just like, hey, painting, how beautiful is this? I'm really enjoying this experience with my kids.
Right.
Or, man, this is a great date. We're really enjoying this. You know, like, and then they're like, oh, my God, this guy's got a homeless vehicle that does what? You know, that's the intervention show, the Christoph Wojtyczko.
Right.
And they're like, but then again, I would say it's just different, too, because, like, young art students that came through the intervention show were just like, that's art in a great way.
Right. Right?
Where they're like, that's amazing. I can do that. I mean, I remember seeing, you know, when I was probably too young to see it, Viennese Actionism, you know, like Hermann Nietzsche with these blood paintings. And and I just thought, you're allowed to do that?
Right.
Or the first time I saw Chris Burden being like crucified, do that Volkswagen.
Yeah.
I just thought, that's art. So I think, you know, different audiences can do different things, and it's okay to sometimes get students of art excited as well. So if anything, I would just, but to go to another point that I make in the book a lot, which you brought up at the very end, which is this, and it's an ongoing thesis for me, which is, I do believe there is a certain kind of unsaid greenhouse effect that comes from a world where we produce so much culture that's out to manipulate you. It takes a toll on our minds.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the result of that is that we are naturally paranoid of cultural material.
Mm.
And if you want to see some side effects of this, though I have no data to prove it, you know, when people wonder why a big swath of the world no longer believes in science or statistics, or that a political candidate can run on no facts whatsoever, I think that that is in certain ways an outgrowth of a world that has become used to people in authority constantly misleading you with information, you know? And that I think at some point people's sense of paranoia is their truth.
Right.
I mean, You know, that, and I would say that that is rife in a lot of things, in fact, that even the political movements more are paranoia or conspiracy-based than productive-based often, you know? And so, and I say that because I think that we find that in the micro level when it comes to art, because the only way you can appreciate ambiguous gestures, the poetic, is you have to have a little trust in your heart.
Right.
That you're going somewhere.
Yeah.
And the only way, you know, if you think this thing is just some bullshit rich person game, you're not going to be like, this is beautiful.
Right.
You have to kind of go in with a certain amount of trust. And trust is a powerful device, particularly. At the same time, I'm so quixotic with this because I think it, at the same time, a lot of the arts is just a luxury game.
Yeah.
And it isn't to be trusted.
Right. Well, I can't help but going back to hopefully not mix metaphors, the greenhouse of the art world community, whatever you want to call it, and the artists within it. You know, you take these two anecdotes, and it's like if you are focusing your art making on your audience, you know, and what you want, how you want to engage your audience, it seems like you're doomed to fail. You know, it kind of goes back to one of those sort of classic full steam ahead with blinders on kind of approach to art making, in which you are doing your own thing and you don't give a shit about what anybody thinks is the way to go. You know, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I'll say a few things to that. I think it poses some riddles that aren't solved with the traditional way of thinking through things. You know, certainly I would say that scale is something that needs to be introduced in these conversations, right? So, for example, to go to Project Row Houses, right? Like, in that space, Rick gets to know who the audience is over time, right? And those subjective relationships are integral to the experience itself. And I would say that a lot of socially engaged art, to name a sort of genre of art making that really focuses on the social relationships in its production, that is a key component of that, right? Which is to be much more specific about those relationships and targeted and developing that with care.
Right.
And that takes many forms, but certainly I think in terms of that, confronting what you just said, a certain aesthetic and political methodology has emerged to deal with that. That said, I would also say the museological kind of framework, that is to say the kind of exhibition format, sometimes can be tricky with those kind of things, you know, with the complete like stranger that only spends 40 seconds in front of your piece. Like, how much of a relationship are you going to develop that way? So it's almost on a case-by-case scenario, you know?
Yeah.
And I would also say, and it's kind of tricky that way, because, of course, I wouldn't want to thus say, hey, so if you want to show a museum, museums should only be places for people that just put the blinders on and go full steam ahead.
Right, right.
Because I don't want to be saying that. I do think, though, that there are some challenges in terms of the relationships to viewer and object that need to be addressed.
Well, you meant when you mentioned scale, that was kind of the way you started off your response. I was thinking about something that we didn't really get into at the beginning, but I'll sort of give a quick recap, which is that after getting out of Santa Clarita, you were in Berkeley and took part in sort of an anarchist style community housing situation, dorm. And you went to the Info Shop, the anarchist bookstore, and then later you went to Chicago and were part of the experimental art space there. And so speaking of small scale, you know, and impacting the community on a very livable small scale, I guess I just wanted to bring that up to the present and ask you to what extent that could continue to be played out with you and Creative Time, or if it's just a completely different playing field and that's not really possible anymore.
Well, it's a few things, and I'm glad you bring it up. So because that kind of scale thing is very important to me.
Mm-hmm.
But it is very different than what I do right now. You know,
yeah.
I do different things at creative time. And I would also say I live in Philadelphia, right? And it's really helpful for me to be a part of a community where I have an arts community where I know people and I know the art spaces and I know some political spaces, and my wife is very involved in our local civic community. And that kind of scale,
mm-hmm.
I find very healthy, you
right.
know? So it's not complete abstractions
right.
all the time.
Right.
But, you know, when I think of, like, our large public artworks here at Creative Time, you know, for example, the Carol Walker piece that we did called A Subtlety, which is this, like, three-story, tall, city block-long sphinx made of sugar.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was 135,000 people that came to see that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a very different – that's like tourism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that's a very different relationship than, say, a Project Row Houses, right?
Sure.
And I do appreciate these kind of monumental gestures that don't necessarily always have these kind of intimate encounters with people, because I think it was still very effective in getting people to discuss things and talk. And,
right.
But it is not the same kind of style, and I think that that's the way Creative Time's operating increasingly, like these big gestures or with big audiences.
Mm.
But we also have this Creative Time Summit we do, which is a kind of gathering every year around the kind of intersection of art and social justice, and we've increasingly been programming more small 10-person, 8-person round tables as part of it, and finding spaces for more intimate connecting and discussion and discursive spaces
mm-hmm.
that touches on that kind of scale issue that's very important to me. So when I think about Creative Time in terms of the things we're doing, that particular space with the summit is where more of those things are connected. And then people have also asked me, hey, why don't you guys do these like long-term projects? Like, why wouldn't Creative Time do a Project Row Houses, for example, right?
Right.
And I think, well, the only problem is then we'd work with one artist entirely for 16 years. And I just don't think that's our remit in some ways. And I am a big fan of time, but people have to understand that time has a capacity limit too, that you can only do so many things at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I am all for artists or people. You know, some people are like, hey, how do I show with Creative Time, or how do I show with this gallery or that gallery? I'm always like, just go make your own gallery.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Go with your friends, go make a space.
Right.
Go put your zine together.
Yeah.
And just do it. And then you're doing it. Rather than being like, I got to get my artist statement together. What? I think it's just, you know, that DIY ethos is deep in me. And I say that for many reasons. One, because on a straightforward level, it's just better to be doing than waiting.
Yeah.
On the second level, I also think it's very, I don't know if you can think back in your life, but you know, like the first time you ever saw something you wrote in print, or the first time like something you did other people looked at, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Those things are powerful. It's a really powerful thing. And it gives you confidence and it gives you a sense of community. And I feel like life's too short to wait for people to give you permission to do that. And so when it comes to building your own worlds, I think that is such a key part of the arts that is so valuable, that it's more than just making art, you know what I mean? It's really making your own place to have a collective form of validation and conversation.
Yeah, and I feel like, having read your book, that wasn't the prescription that you were giving overtly, but it was a subtext that sort of ran throughout, you know, that taking your own agency, seeing your own power, you know, that's kind of how you presented it. And by the way, speaking of what you just said, I wanted to quote your book because I think it's a good segue. You know, speaking of what you just said, you wrote, in activist circles, the term radicalized embodies the condition of becoming provoked by all of the groups and artists I've described. We often find the term used in a phrase like, I became radicalized during the Occupy Wall Street protests. It describes the moment when people who normally considered the regular channels of governmental reform sufficient see the fabric of social life tear before their eyes. It is a moment when they suddenly become aware of the power of collective action and witness a stark contrast between the rhetoric of capitalist democracy and its nascent mechanisms of discipline and control. And you cite, you go on to cite the RNC conventions of 04 and 08, Occupy Wall Street, Black Lives Matter. So the question, having stated all that, is, you alluded to it, what was your radicalized moment?
Yeah.
Do you have one?
Well, what I'm trying to think through it. Well, certainly I have some obvious ones. I'm trying to think of the key early ones because, I mean, certainly the biggest one for me was.
And so ends part one. What a fucking tease, huh? Sorry about that. Hey, it's coming up. That answer is coming up next week. I hope you got a lot out of that. You know, look up those artist groups. Look up those artists. Go ahead and buy the book. Hopefully it's out in paperback now. I don't know if it is, but just buy the book. It's a tremendous resource. Austin Thomas, thank you so much again for connecting NATO to me. And Austin herself, I mention her because when she mentioned him, she said she was incredibly influenced by this book. So go ahead and get it. If nothing else, you have this conversation to listen to and one more coming up. If you would like to support this show, meanwhile, I want to thank several of you in the last week or so who have donated to the show. You all seem to have chosen to remain anonymous, and I would totally respect that. I just wanted to send a big thank you to all of you. You know who you are. If you have not donated the show yet, as I've said many times, I love nothing more, frankly, than getting great support for the show, but also getting these emails in a certain section of the inbox that's called updates. And it says, you received a PayPal donation from ... I love getting those. It really means a lot. I mean, for somebody who's taken that extra step and made that donation, especially a substantial one, there's nothing like it. So thank you again to you guys. Of course, you can also support the show by going to the iTunes page of the Conversation Art Podcast. You can link there through the website, theconversationpod.com, or you can just go to iTunes and look up the Conversation Unartist Podcast. It's very much appreciated when we get reviews because it helps other people find the show. And if you are not aware, we have a survey that's ongoing, theconversationpod.com/survey. Please fill it out. It'll let us know best how to program the show going forward. And if you only have time for a few minutes, just fill out questions 7, 8, and 9. I think those are the most important. But please do fill it out at your convenience. It would be very much appreciated. Of course, you can also follow the show on social media at Artist Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. And like the show on Facebook. We did hit that milestone of 1,000 a couple weeks ago. But, you know, always happen to have more Facebook fans. So I don't know what that's going to mean ultimately when we get 100,000. You know, like the 135,000 visitors to A Subtlety. That's basically all I want. I just want 135,000 listeners to this show. You think that's too much to ask? Thank you guys so much for being here, for listening to the show. I really hope you got a tremendous amount of value out of listening to that, as I certainly have, listening and editing that footage, and there's only more to come next week. So stay tuned to the answer to that question. And one more thing, we are in the sort of infancy stages of another podcast that I am going to host. It's going to be conversations with people who are just getting by. Obviously, a lot of these artists/activists would probably qualify. So, NATO, if you want to recommend any, I'm open to suggestions. But basically, we're talking about a show that's going to be called something along the lines of How I Get By, Notes from the Gig Economy, something along those lines. And if you have a better idea for a title, I am more than happy to hear it. But it's going to be short 15 to 20 minute conversations with people about how they are getting by, whether it's, you know, a job that doesn't take very much time. It gives them time to do what they want to do with the rest of their time, or it's a string of gigs put together that creates a very weird schedule and a very schizophrenic sort of income. Because I know you know a lot of people. I know a lot of you are like that. And I want to open it up to a more mainstream, you know, not just art niche audience. So that's the general objective of that idea. All right. So happy to hear from you with suggestions of potential guests, show titles, and so on. Thank you so much for being here. I will talk to you, and Nada will talk to you next week. Ciao for now.